Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace,
A Touch of Grace.
Literary Magic on Blog Talk Radio.
It is that time again for another episode of I Artist on A Touch of Grace, and I am your host, G.D., bringing you some of the most gifted and influential people on the planet. Today's date is January 30th, 2014, and the time is 1:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Now listen up close. He is the winner of 3 prestigious NAACP Theater Awards, as well as 3 Drama Log Awards for writing, directing, and co-producing the stage play, Ritual. He made his film writing directorial debut with the film version, which was voted the jury award at the 2000 Pan-African Film Festival. In the documentary realm, he wrote and directed the documentary You Are Not Alone, which was an examination of depression among black gay men. A mainstay on the theater circuit, he has written and directed projects winning a GLAAD Award for his Children of the Night and produced the world premiere of Willie and Esther, which was a Los Angeles Times Critics' Choice and won 2 LA Weekly Awards. He lent his directorial talent to the premiere production of B-Boy Blues, the play, adapted from the best-selling James Earl Hardy classic novel. As an actor, he has guest starred in more than, get this, 50 TV and film productions, including Good Times, Cheers, Minstrel Man, James McConaughey's Dynasty, Cannonball, and All the President's Men. From 1991 to 2001, he edited and published SBC Magazine, then the most widely distributed national monthly for the black LGBT community. He has also authored 5 incredible books that explore the romantic lives of gay people of color. This impressive resume is not a conclusive list of all his creative ventures and awards, but you get the picture. Stanley Bennett Clay is one bad man, and I welcome him to A Touch of Grace. So, Stanley, welcome.
Thank you so much, GD. Glad to be here.
Great, great, great. So the first question that I have, where did life begin for you, and when did you tap into your creative genius?
Well, I was born in Chicago and lived there for 12 years, and then my family moved to Los Angeles. But actually, I started writing at a very, very young age. I was just so fascinated with reading, and I was reading when I was like 7 or 8 years old. I was reading the Bible and was just fascinated with the stories. So I just started sketching stuff and writing stories and things like that. And I actually wrote my first play, which was a musical, when I was 12. And because I played the piano and played it by ear, and so I was writing music and stuff. And so I wrote this show, produced it, and directed it in my family's living room, and sold tickets to all the neighbors. And my mother baked, she cooked popcorn and everything, and we sold that. And we put the show on when I was 12 years old. So that was kind of my first thing with an audience.
Well, you know what? Your mom sounds like she was such a support for you. And at such an early age, I mean, I'm trying to go back in time to remember what I was doing at that age, but probably playing with dolls or something, but most certainly.
Well, I was doing that too.
So we shared something in common as well.
And also, you know, I wanted to also say, because, you know, my father, which is probably the greatest man that I've ever known personally in life, was extremely supportive. I mean, he worked all the time, and he always made sure that whatever I needed, I had it with regards to music and encouragement, things like that, because he was also a musician as well as a mailman. And so he was just a wonderful, wonderful support system. He and my mother provided me with such inspiration and enthusiasm throughout my entire life.
Well, a music messenger and a great encouragement. I just have to tell you that I'm in awe. I'm smiling. I think that's just incredible. So that would probably lead me to my next question. I kind of already know why, but I'm just going to ask for the people who have tuned in today. In this world of bigotry, racism, sexism, and homophobia, Where did you find the courage to live life on your terms without guilt or shame?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if it had that much to do with courage. When I was very young, my parents obviously knew I was gay. They didn't say anything, but they knew. I didn't even know what it was, this attraction that I had for other men. But as a young child, not really knowing other people that were like me, it was, you know, sort of a lonely life. And then I guess when I turned around, 17, 18 years old, and we were living in Los Angeles, and I went to this theater called the Ebony Showcase Theater, which is, you know, the oldest black theater in Los Angeles. And they were putting this production on called Carnival Island. And I just wanted to go there and work, and I said I'd sweep floors and do whatever I needed to do just to be a part of the theater scene there. And they said, sure. So I started working there, volunteering, and they were doing this show, and it was a show with all of these guys in it because it was a Caribbean musical. So they had all these dancers that were Caribbean dancers, and they were mostly all gay. And suddenly I realized, I said, wow, there's a whole world of people like me. And on top of the fact that these were all extremely accomplished people because they were working at theaters all throughout the city, and they were very honorable, they were very dignified, they were very talented. And I said, wow, I'm part of a very special sort of group. So by the time I turned 19, I came completely out. And that was in 1969, I guess the same year as Stonewall. So life was not difficult, and being openly gay was certainly not a difficult – it was no more difficult for me than being black.
Wow. That's incredible, because the terrain has been rugged for African-American people of color as a whole, but then that added element of being black and gay can make it even more challenging. So in your travels and in your experiences, what have been some of the – biggest obstacles you have had to face along your trail as you were trailblazing?
Well, I would have to say that, and I don't know if I would call these obstacles, but the fact that I ran into so many people who were facing obstacles and who did not have the support system that I had. And so I felt obligated to always encourage other gay people of color that it is okay to love yourself, and that it is okay to do the things that you need to do to keep yourself happy, and happy not in the definition of life from someone else, but in your own personal definition of your life. And I always looked at it from the point of view that, I'm left-handed. And there was a time that they used to burn left-handed people at the stake because they thought they were demonic. And just like, you know, there's a huge group of people who don't like black people. Well, guess what? I can't feed into their hatred. I can't feed into their bigotry. What I can do is live my life loving myself, loving my blackness, loving my left-handedness, loving my gayness, because those are all things that God made me. He made me special in those three areas. And therefore, it is my obligation to be not only proud of that, but to be appreciative of the fact that I do have special qualities and that I am not like everybody else. I am gay. I am a minority in that. I am black. I am a minority in that. I am left-handed. I am a minority in that. And to me, being a minority means that you are unique and you are special.
I love that. I love that. And I'm so glad that it's being recorded, because someone going back listening to this will find the courage to let them know that they are not alone, that they are not, you know, a mistake. And that was the biggest thing for me to face, is that, you know, realizing that you're not a mistake. So I want to thank you for putting together the documentary You Are Not Alone, because depression and suicide are relevant factors in the lives of a lot of us. And can you share with us how you approached this project and what the feedback was like?
Actually, I was hired to write and direct it by the producer of the project, and I didn't really know that much about it until he said, "Well, I'm doing this documentary, and I need a director." So I said, "Oh, well, hey, why don't you hire me?" So he did, and as I got into it and started really examining it, since I did not really go through the heavy depression that so many have gone through in our community, that it was an eye-opener, and what it did was that it encouraged me more to reach out and to make sure that I am there to offer whatever support and encouragement that I can for those who are going through this thing. And I didn't realize how widespread it was. And, you know, when we live in a world that teaches us that because we are in the minority that there's something wrong with us, I think we have to change that desperately. We have to do that because, you know, just like the Constitution was designed to protect the minorities from the tyranny of the majority, we have to take this on ourselves as well, that we must protect ourselves from the tyranny of the majority, because there is this sense that because you are the majority that you are right and anything else is wrong. Well, that is not correct. And we have to always believe that. White people in this country have always believed that because they are white and they are the majority, that is the way that our lives should be. Well, that's not true. Just like it is not true that just because the majority is heterosexual does not necessarily mean that it is the only way that you must live your life. You must live your life the way God has created you to live your life, or whatever you believe in, and whatever that great power source is that you believe in created you a certain way. And your way is unique, is different from someone else's way, and therefore you must embrace your differentness and love yourself.
You know, I'm just so grateful. I believe that the first book that I read was Just As I Am by Elin Harris. I didn't read Invisible Life first. I read that one. And then, of course, I went on to read B-Boy Blues, and later on I read some of your work, Invisible Lies. And I just think that because of people like you, I have grown into confidence as a black gay man out here. But let's talk about mainstream for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Shows like
Sure.
Modern Family, Will and Grace, and, of course, you know, Ellen, showcase the white perspective of gay life. And some of what is presented is quite stereotypical. So how far do you think we've come as African Americans in adding our life experiences to the mainstream?
Well, you know what, even though we don't see as much as we need to see, I think that we've come a very long way. Once again, because of our numbers, and that's just a fact, just like in mainstream black films, we still don't see as much as we need to see, but simply because the numbers are not there. The point of fact is that white people don't necessarily go to see black films, and white people are the majority, which means that more white films get made simply from the dollar point of view, is that, you know, those movies that make the most money are the films that are the ones that are being made. So it's up to us to create our own thing. When I first started publishing, I realized that looking at all the white gay publications out there, that we weren't being represented. So it was our responsibility to create our own publications, so which is the reason why I created SBC Magazine. But the same thing is true with film. With books, we have to create those things, and we have to get them out there to the public. And the other thing, too, is that we cannot ghettoize our lives, that we need to share our stories, we need to share our movies, we need to share our books, we need to share our art with everyone. We need to share them with our straight family members. We need to share it with our straight friends, just like we share our lives with our straight friends and our straight family members. So we can't just stay in that small closet called just the gay bars and just the gay community and just the gay ghetto. We have to expand ourselves so that we are a part of the entire society. We are those unique members in this society, and that's what we have to do.
I agree absolutely, and I know with the NBA player that came out of the closet, some of the NFL players that have come out the closet, and we are boxers, and we are lawyers, and we are doctors. We actually show up everywhere. And
absolutely.
Bayard Rustin, yeah, we do. You know, and Bayard Rustin, I'm not sure how many people know this man, but he was one of Dr. Martin Luther King's right-hand men, and not many people know about him and his courage during the Civil Rights era. There are still
exactly.
So many who look at, yeah, they look at homosexuality as an abomination. So have the strides we have made so far, do you think it's been enough to change and have a shift in the thinking about that?
Well, you know, I think it is changing, and I think it's changing rapidly. One of the things that I thank for that are the various social networks, because right now no one can squash our voices anymore. There was a time when, you know, if you wanted information out there, you had to go to the LA Times or the New York Times or the three networks or, you know, certain publications. Now, everybody has a voice, And now people are beginning to understand, wow, how expansive and influential the gay community is, and the black gay community, how powerful it is. Because we are seeing it, we are reading about it. You can go to Facebook at any time and see any article on anyone gay, and we're everywhere. And then, you know, even, you know, when I look at the fact that at the Grammy Awards that they had the gay weddings there, and Quincy Lanier and DeAndre Gossett getting married on stage was unbelievable, especially when you consider that they've been together in a committed relationship for 18 years, and they are major figures in our black gay community, and there they were standing up there actually getting married, and it was just a powerful, powerful moment. And it's symbols like that that we see and that we understand and we embrace and we are moved by is the thing. These are the things that will move us to continue to empower ourselves and help others empower themselves as well.
I was going to ask you that question, and thank you so much for elaborating on that. I was wondering what your thoughts are about the historical spectacle, because it was definitely historical, and I know there was backlash from that, from, you know, the people out there, the religious leaders, some of them, you know, that really kind of are trying to hold on to these old beliefs about who you are and who you are supposed to love. I think that was an incredible statement made by the music industry. So your contributions to the House of John, which is part of the Visible Lies book, the tribute to Elin Harris, is how you met your partner of 10 years. And so since we're talking about gay marriage, how did the two of you meet, and when are the wonderful nuptials going to occur?
Well, the first question is pretty much explained in the book. My meeting him 10 years ago, his name is Rene Santos, he's a Dominican, was when I was vacationing in the Dominican Republic. And it was just such a wonderful, romantic sort of, wow, I'm blushing here now. It was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing that happened to us. And the love has been incredible. And I actually proposed to him when I was in D.C. With B-Boy Blues on the day that the Supreme Court struck down DOMA. And on that day, I called him immediately and proposed to him. So we will be getting married this year. We haven't set a date yet, but we will definitely be married this year. And it's going to be great.
It will be great. And again, I want to say congratulations. I'm so proud of you guys and for your courage and your loving each other, because that is also an issue too that is faced within our community, you know, that a lot of relationships don't last because people, you know, it's more, a lot of people from the outside looking in believe that being gay is a sexual experience, and it's not just a sexual experience, you know. And most certainly now with the gift of marriage now, we can actually own a plot in each other's lives so that, you know, benefits are opened up to us, because companies are now extending benefits to same-sex partners, which I think is fantastic. So,
oh, yes, and not to mention, you know, in most areas where gay marriage is legal, that the tax revenues from wedding ceremonies and from everything that is attended to that are just incredible. So, you know, there's a lot of money in it for principalities and for cities and for states and for areas, you know, with regards to taxes.
Because let's face it, you know, they don't mind spending our money.
Oh, not a bit. No, I was just going to say that, you know, these last 4 years of me living here in New York, and when I first moved here, you know, knowing that this was a state that had gay marriage, it was so revealing to me to watch the casualness of how being gay is so completely accepted here, that it's just part of the fabric of life. And I love New York City for that. I love New York State for that.
That's incredible. Hopefully I'll get a chance to go back there and visit. My grandmother lived in the Bronx for many years, and
cool.
We were back there in the Bronx, back in the 70s. She owned a barbecue restaurant, and may she rest in peace, Paralee Whitlock. I just, you know, she was a fast woman, I got to tell you.
Good for her.
But I think that's incredible. So, you know, I first met you during your visit to Oakland back in 2010, where both you and James Earl were touring promoting the highly acclaimed effort for the late Elin Harris. It was a tribute called Visible Lives, which I have my autographed copy. Terrence Dean was also a part of that, too. So who put the fire under that pot to get the water boiling on this project?
Well, you know, it was actually Terrence Dean. Terrence, myself, and James have been friends for a while. And I was on the phone with Terrence, and you know, like authors do, we just get on the phone and we talk business, talk shop, and gossip and all that kind of stuff. And Elin had passed, and Terrence was just saying, you know, we were both kind of saying that, wow, you know, with Elin gone, that's going to leave a huge void with regards to just the powerful representation for literary artists, because he was so popular that he put a huge face on black gay literature. And so with him gone, you know, a lot of the wind could have been taken out of it. And Terrence kept saying that, you know, we cannot let Elin be forgotten. And he said, well, you know, what we need to do is we need to put a tribute book together. I said, yeah, that would be cool. So he said, well, let's call James Earl Hardy. And it was like, you know, hey, let's call Mikey. You know, he'll eat it. And so what we did was we called James, and James said, hey, that's a good idea. So, you know, then we called our agents. And what had happened was that they had contacted Kensington Books, and Kensington Books liked the idea. Now, we hadn't written a word, and we already had a deal. So now it was like, oh, shit, we got to now sit down and write the book. So it just happened so fast that it was amazing. But it was just a matter of months, and the next thing we know, the book was out on the market.
Well, you know, I really love how you wrote, because I read all three stories in the book. Of course, James Earl's was the extension of B-Boy Blues, which we're always hungry for. And then there was your part in the book that was just, I mean, you write so incredibly vivid. I felt like I was down there in the tropics, you know, at the place where they had the guys, and you know, when the guys fell in love with the call boy, and I just thought it was incredible. So again, you have a clean. It was. I mean, I tell you, if I wanted escapism, I got it.
Mm-hmm. Oh wow, cool. Well, you know what? I think what it is because I come from a film background. So it's, you know, I tend to write very cinematically, simply because
you know
it's in my life, you know, forever.
Well, you know what, that's the perfect word for it, cinematically, because that's exactly the experience that I got, you know. I could easily see it going to film, and I would love to see that happen. Are there any talks about turning that story into film?
Well, actually, you know, I've been thinking about turning my novel Looker into a film, because it just logistically it may be a little easier to do that one first, since we could shoot it right here in the States, and I could shoot it in California, as opposed to having to take a full film crew to the Dominican Republic right now. But I really do want to tell that film or tell that story on film. But you know, one project at a time, because right now I'm involved with some things, including, you know, putting my play Ritual back up here off Broadway this year. So it's like my plate is so full that I'm trying to get around to all the different projects that I need to do.
Yeah, you know what? Your plate is very full. So during the intro, I presented to the listeners an inconclusive list of all your accomplishments. So you're a writer, but then you're a director as well as an actor. How are you able to, Stanley, wear so many hats? My God.
Well, you know what it is that, you know, I have a big sandbox, and I have a lot of toys in my sandbox. So, you know, I play with one for a while, then I go to the next one, then I'll go to the next one, I'll go to the next one. And that's kind of how I do it. I mean, the writing part is probably the easiest, because I can do that at home and work on my different writing projects just sitting here without having to get up and go somewhere. But what happens is that when an acting situation comes up, well, then, you know, I'll go and do that and stop the writing, or, continue it, but not concentrate on it as much. And the directing thing is the fact that you know, people are always asking me, you know, to direct things. And it's really hard to turn down, you know, a good project, especially, you know, when you know, someone offers you B-Boy Blues, how do you turn that down? Everything. So I do that. I think the hardest thing for me right now, and has always been, is the music. Because, you know, writing music and also because the kind of music that I write more Broadway-style music where you need full orchestras and everything. And it's just the, you know, the amount of money that's involved in hiring so many musicians and getting the arrangements done and things like that and getting the singers and all of that. So that's a little more difficult. But the year after, but in 2015, I am going to put my musical up, which I've workshopped. But the full musical will end up off Broadway in 2015. So it's you know, it's and also I'm a workaholic, and because I completely and totally enjoy all the things that I do, so none of it is like work. In fact, I mean, it's, you know, it's like the old cliche. It's just I'm amazed that people actually pay me to do things that, you know, I would have done for free, you know, because I just enjoy doing all of the things that I do. And I tend to, you know, I work around the clock. I get up early and I start working, and I'm always working on something. I never have writer's block because if I get stuck on one project, I'll switch over to another project and start working on that until I can get unstuck on that other project. So, you know, so it's just a matter of just doing things, and suddenly I wake up and I see all these things that I've finished. I say, wow, when did I do all that?
Wow. Well, you know what? When I was watching The Asphalt Grow, thinking how it all looked Hand Me Down, I had no idea that you starred in legendary sitcoms such as Good Times. You know, How did you, yeah, you know, I had to do that plug in there because I like that song, Watching the Asphalt Grow, thinking how it all looked Hand Me Down. How did you get involved in sitcoms, and what year was that when all that started?
Well, that was actually in 1975. But I actually started acting in on film and TV in 1968. The first job I ever did was in a segment of the original Bill Cosby show, which when he played the gym teacher, Chet Kincaid, and I was a little high school student. And what had happened was that, you know, I was doing acting in high school and the whole thing, and I had decided that I wanted to do this as a profession. So during that summer when I graduated, I just went out there and started looking around, and also, you know, the advantage of living in the Hollywood area, where the motion picture industry is kind of like the car industry is to Detroit. It's just almost everybody's in the business because it's a company town. So it was very easy for me to get in the industry, and also, you know, because I graduated from high school, I was 18 years old, but I looked very, very young. So when you look very, very young, and then you get hired a lot simply because that way they don't have to have a teacher on the set if you're over 18, and you can still play 14, 15 years old. So part of it had to do with me being talented, and part of me had to do with being, you know, the right look and the right age at the right time and being
wow.
in the right city.
Wow. So someone else who's working with Tyler Perry, a friend of mine that I used to work with at AT&T, explained it just that way. You know, she looks young. I mean, she has adult daughters now, but because she looks so young, she's usually picked for these parts. But I think that that's a very interesting concept and very savvy on the part of the industry. So I want to go back a little bit to the stage plays. Another young lady, Adrienne L. Williams, who's out of Las Vegas, her stage play, In Lust from Hell, she was talking about the cost. She said it cost, and she footed the bill out of her pocket, some $40,000 to put on that stage play. And so I know that tickets are going well for B-Boy Blues because it just keeps going on and on. So how do you find backing for that? Is it just because people know you? What is that whole thing like?
You know, a lot of that has to do with people knowing you. Now I don't know what the financing process is for B-Boy Blues because I'm not the producer of B-Boy Blues. I'm just the director. So I was just hired to do B-Boy Blues. But for my own productions, the thing is that when people see you do a play and they see that it's successful, it's pretty easy to get backing simply because people say, well, you know, they know what they're doing, and I can make my money back. So, you know, that's the key, is that, you know, you have to put on your businessman's hat to produce a show. It's not, you know, I don't like producing it as much as I like all the other things. In fact, I like producing I don't like it very much. It's the least thing that I like, simply because it's all about business and very little to do with the art. You hire the artist and everything, but you produce the play, and you pay for it, and you make sure that you try to turn a profit with it. So it's hard bookkeeping work and a lot of smoozing and talking to a lot of people and trying. You know, it's like trying to talk a gorgeous guy out of his clothes. That's what you have to do. You have to talk these rich people out of their money and say, that I'm a good financial lay.
Yeah. Right. So, when you say talk a gorgeous guy out of his clothes, some of them gorgeous guys are traps.
Well, that is true. That is true. But the thing is, their gorgeousness is like, a rich man's money. Yeah, and the thing is, and if you can convince them that you're a good lay, you're a good financial lay, then they're going to give you the money.
Yeah, I have to tell you right now that it's all about money. Money definitely makes the world go round. I got a chance to see The Wolves of Wall Street, and it was a wild ride. I really enjoyed the movie. Leonardo DiCaprio depicted, a greedy dopehead. Perfectly, because that's really what it's all about, But so when you start getting into this mainstream and you're in the spotlight, there are a lot of pressures that come along with that. So how do you maintain your cool and your composure?
Well, I think that it comes naturally to me simply because I learned a long time ago, and I learned this from my parents, is that, stress is a killer. And stress does not get anything done. I have never been cursed at in my entire life by my parents. I have never been yelled and screamed at by my parents. It just wasn't their style. And they don't stress things. They would just kind of say, okay, we're going to sit here, we're going to try to figure this out. Because their philosophy was that you can't figure anything out if you're stressing. You have to calm down and try to figure it out, So I was kind of, reared that way. And the thing is, I think it also has a lot to do with the fact that there's something very calming in the fact when you have not only, two great parents, but I have seven brothers and sisters. So when you're living in a house together with all these people, you tend to be very adjustable. You realize that, okay, there's only so much space and you can't get upset over the fact that you can't do this or you can't do that or you can't do that because, certain things have to be split with my parents, 10 different ways. And you just learn to compromise and you just learn to not get upset over little things. So I don't I don't involve myself with people who are stress prone. As well, I try to avoid those kinds of people who are backstabbing and people who a lot of grumbling and all that. That's all a waste of time. And I don't have that kind of time to waste. I'm too busy having a good time.
It really is a waste of time, and that explains a lot because if James Earl Hardy, his presence was like a warm invitation to a Southern dinner, yours was very energetic and composed and poised and confident. It explains a lot. So, kudos to your parents for being able to have a house full of kids and there be some type of calm and peace and active communication taking place because that's a biggie for me. I was worked at Stanford University for a couple of years, and that's the big thing that they emphasize is that, a lot of people really don't know how to communicate properly. So that's why you see, people on the internet and, the yelling and the screaming. It really doesn't get anything accomplished. But on that note, I want to talk about all the awards, the NAACP Theater Awards, the Writing and Directing Awards. What does the sense of accomplishment feel like within your spirit?
Well, the awards aside, because first of all, you don't do it for the awards. You simply try to do the very best work that you can, And the icing on the cake is the fact that when someone gives you an award, or it's kind of, oh, okay. In fact, I mean, I remember when I won the not the NAACP Theater Awards, but when I won the Best Actor Image Award, I wasn't even at the ceremony. I was producing a show down the street, and I didn't want to leave the theater. I said, well, I'm not going to win anyway. So I stayed there, you know, with my show and everything, and then people rushed in and they said, you just won the Image Award. I said, oh, okay, well, that was kind of nice. There's a great deal of gratitude in that, because the thing is that people are saying to you that they like what you do and they respect what you do. So it's a good feeling, but once again, you don't do it for that. I don't sit down to write a book to try to win an award to write a book. I sit down to write the best book that I possibly can, because if I'm asking someone to spend $10 to $25 for a book, I want them to get their money's worth. If I'm putting on a play and, you know, I'm going to direct it and or write it the best way I can, because people are spending money for this product. And I want them to leave the theater knowing that they got their money's worth. And I think, because James has written such an incredible adaptation of his play, B-Boy Blues, that we so get that. I mean, the audiences are just unbelievable in their love and their affection for the show. And, you know, we've seen people, the same people at the theater, no matter what city they were in. We said, weren't you at the New York production? Yeah, and you might be in D.C. And we see this constantly, and we know that, okay, then we're giving them our very best. That's what we want to do. And I think that, you know, one of the great things, especially with James, is that he is so, so easy to work with. That he is a director's dream when it comes to a playwright. And he's got great listening ears. He's very innovative, and he's very easygoing with regards to me as a director and with our actors as well. Everybody loves James. He's just a cool dude.
You know what? You said it just like that. He's just a cool dude, and mm-hmm. I so appreciate all of the imagery that you have given for people of color who are gay, and also, you know, people who are not gay, because it mm-hmm. gives them a better understanding of who we are as human beings, and I think that that's just incredible. So I wanted to go back just a little bit, because we grazed over this. You worked with, you know, the Good Times crew, and that was Bernadette Stanis and, you know, the late great Esther Rolle and Jimmy Walker.
Right.
And then you also worked on the set of Cheers with Rhea Perlman and those people. You also worked with Cosby. So was there any one person in all of your wonder that just you were in their presence and it was just like, oh, my God, I can't believe it, and you had those butterflies? Was there one person that you've encountered along the way that it stirred that up in you?
Absolutely, and it was my idol, and the person that the reason why I became an actor, even though I never worked with him, but I met him on a few occasions, and I auditioned for him, Sidney Poitier.
Ooh.
It was just that you know, I remember seeing him in Lilies of the Field when I was I think 13 years old, and just was blown away by his dignity and the way he stood there and stood up and this dignified black man. And it got to the point where I even started acting like Sidney Poitier. I love that man so much and still love him, you know. Not to mention the fact that he has to be just drop-dead gorgeous, especially when he was young. He was a gorgeous, gorgeous, beautiful, beautiful black man, just unbelievable. So everything about him, and the one thing that I loved about Sidney Poitier, and actually I did work with him. I did voiceovers on a film of his, and he was directing us vocally. And the one thing that I loved about him was as dignified and as regal as he was, that he was very, very, I'm not going to say humble, but there was a thing that he always called me Mr. Clay. And I'm just like a kid. And he would call everyone Mr. or Miss, you know, and it didn't matter. You could be a bit player, an extra or anything like that. And he was very gracious. He would extend his hand and shake your hand. And he was just, you know, he didn't carry himself like I know I'm a star. You know, he was just very gracious to everyone. That's the best way to put it. And I found that to be true with everyone who's ever met him, that we always find that word to use when we describe Sidney Poitier, his graciousness. He's just such a wonderful, wonderful, warm and gracious person. with a very easy smile, and he seems to be very interested in you. You know, so,
I think that's an incredible description of him because, of course, you know, I think I've seen Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and the one where he was a school teacher, you know, over in Europe with those, you know, those kids over there. I just think that he was just so poised and it is just must have been an incredible experience for you. So you've led and are leading an incredible life. And what have you learned from your earlier life to now? What would you think would be the main thing that you've learned from when you first started to where you are now?
That don't regret your mistakes, learn from your mistakes, that they're all lessons. And I know that's sort of a cliche, but it's because it's so true that nobody's perfect. You know, I can be a bumbling idiot at times and make some some dumb, stupid decisions. And it's okay because I learn from that, or at least I try to learn from that. And sometimes when I don't learn from that, that is a mistake. So you know, I look at, you know, I love being God's perfect, imperfect child. And when I do crazy things or silly things, it's okay. The one thing that I want to make sure that I don't do is in my silliness and my craziness and things that I am not cruel. And I don't, you know, belittle people, and I don't put other people down and things like that. I try my best not to do those things because there's something evil in that. And I, you know, I'm okay with making mistakes, but I don't want to do anything that is socially or humanistically nefarious.
I think it's incredible. I think you're an incredible man. So now your books, you know, there are five, if I'm not mistaken, five books. What are the names of your books for the listeners?
Let's see, Diva, In Search of Pretty Young Black Men, Looker, you know, my segment of Visible Lives, which is House of John. I'm forgetting something. Oh, and then I have my Dominican Heat series, which consists of five books unto itself. I've three of the books are already out, which is Aching for It, Hollywood Flames, and Madam Frankie. I'm working on the fourth book now, which will be out in around June. I don't have the release date as yet. And then I have one more book of that series that I have to finish before the end of the summer. So it's been kind of crazy, you know, trying to get all these books out because it turns out that in 2 years I would have written five books in the 2 years, you know. So it's good work. It's good. You know what it's like? It's like going to the gym. Sure, you sweat and you exercise and you're exhausted, but you know when you're done, it's a really really good feeling.
That's wonderful, and I just have to tell you that to hear you explain it, no wonder things come out so composed with you. You know, you definitely are delivering a good product. I know that we've got the Ian Polk out there that did an incredible job with the Noah's Ark series, and again,
absolutely.
Yeah, he really did, and then I actually got a chance to see Punks with
His first film. I mean, you know, can you believe that? It was so polished for someone jumping out there the first time. I was like, in fact, his film was screening at the Gay and Lesbian Festival in Los Angeles the same time that my film Ritual was screening there, and I was just blown away by that.
Yeah, and you know what's so funny in our films, because there's always this search for, you know, the alpha male, you know, and Rockman Dunbar has appeared in a couple of the films that Ian Polk has done, and you know, makes no qualms that he has no problem playing a gay man. As we wind down, I just wanted to know, what are your thoughts about, you know, straight men playing gay roles? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I think that that's fine. It's just like, you know, I mean, needless to say, obviously most of the roles that I played were straight. So if a gay man can play straight roles, why shouldn't a straight man be able to play gay roles? They're roles. It's all about acting. You know, it's fine, because the thing is, I would hate to have a terrible gay actor play, you know, a gay role when a great straight actor can play it better. You know, I mean, I don't know. You know, it's like when I look at Brokeback Mountain, I thought the casting was perfect.
It was. It was an incredible movie.
They played those roles, and I didn't care whether they were gay or straight. You know, the point is that story was told so well by the interpretation of those two actors. And,
right,
and the other thing,
right,
too, is that, you know, everybody in Hollywood knew that Rock Hudson was gay for years. It was no big thing, but we didn't have the social network and we didn't have all the information out there that the rest of the world knew it. Now, he was a matinee idol, you know, with every woman in Hollywood on film. And he did a wonderful job with those light romantic comedies that he used to do back in the 50s and the 60s, you know. And he's as gay as Pink Ink.
He did, and so was Robert Reed as a Brady Bunch, because that was another one of my
exactly.
favorites. You know,
exactly.
So,
and you know, a dear friend of mine, and you may not remember this actor, but Raymond St. Jacques, who was in the Cotton Comes to Harlem movies and everything, and was, you know, playing these big macho black men, and Raymond, you couldn't get any gayer than Raymond. You know, and
I'm gonna have to look him up.
Yeah, and he was openly gay, and that was the thing.
Wow.
You know, he was not in the closet at all, but he was always hired because he had that big booming voice and this stature and everything. But he was always hired, and everybody knew. You know,
wow.
I mean, everybody knew that I was gay, and I was being in the role. You know, I would always, you know, I would be hired to play the gang leader, you know, and stuff like that, and the tough guy.
So the moral of this story, of this segment, is, you know, you can never judge a book by its cover. You just never can. And so the final question that I have for you,
mm-hmm.
because it's been an incredible 45 minutes with Stanley Bennett Clay, author,
my
director.
It's been great with you too, my friend.
Yeah, it has just been incredible. So I'd like to ask this question. How would
mm-hmm.
you like to be remembered after the journey is done?
That in my life, I offer truth, that when I realized that for those first few years of my life, when I was up until about 16, 17 years old, when I was forgivably not in love with myself simply because I didn't know any better. But as I learned from my parents to love myself and had the support of their love, and I was able to go out there and be a proud black gay man and live my entire life as that. That is what I want to be remembered as someone who tried his best to live in truth. And certainly as far as who I am as a black man, who I am as a gay man, I live that in complete and total truth. Sometimes when I'm on stage, I'm not living truth, but that's okay. But
right,
things
right.
that count.
You're just acting. You're just acting.
Yeah, because I'm acting, yeah. But the thing is that I don't try to act in life, you know. Stage is fine. When I write those fictitious stories, you know, I'm making up characters and things like that. That's one thing. But when it comes to life itself, that if I can be an example for others to just live your life fully, and it comes from learning to love yourself. And once you do that, you can't live any other way. It's like I can't even imagine – you know, living my life as a white man. I can't even imagine living my life as a straight man. That's not me. I can't even imagine living my life as a right-handed man. You know, it's not me.
Yeah. Well, there certainly is no switch to switch us from gay to being straight. And it's that old cliche, to thine own self be true. And I want to thank you for being true. It's been an incredible 45 minutes, and I just want to say the door is always open here for you at A Touch of Grace. If you ever need exposure for anything, as if you really need anything from me, but
you know what? Thank you so much, and guess what, GD? You know, do understand that for all writers, for all artists, the thing is that our audiences have become our most important patrons, you know, thank you for connecting me with your audience, and thank you for supporting me with, you know, with my books and things like that. We appreciate it. You know, well, you know, because you're an author yourself, so you know what that's like, you know, to get the audience appreciation. So thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you. And the door is always open. And everybody, thanks for tuning in to this incredible episode. I'm going to go back and listen to it because that's usually when I enjoy the most. I enjoy the interviewing part of it, but I just like listening to some stuff that I might have missed because I was concentrating on my guests. So Stanley Bennett Clay, much more success to you. Congratulations on the upcoming nuptials. Keep me posted. And God bless
you. I
will.
You too, GD. Thank you so much. Have a good
evening. You're welcome. Take care. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. All right. Fans of A Touch of Grace, I just want to say, you know, 30,000 plus visit this platform every day. I enjoy the talent that I have on because I think that they're inspiring, they're incredible, and they're actually out there living in their own truth. And if you do anything in this life, make sure you're living in your own truth because at the end, it really doesn't matter. You know, we were born in this world alone, and we're going to leave out of here alone. So in between, do the right thing. Be yourself. Love you lots. Take care.